You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest is Stephen J. Ross. He's a professor of history at USC and the author of several books, including Movies and American Society, Hollywood Left and Right, How Movie Stars Shaped American Politics, and Working Class Hollywood, Silent Film and the Shaping of Class in America. His latest book was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, Hitler in Los Angeles, How Jews Foiled Nazi Plots Against Hollywood and America. Stephen J. Ross, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, there's been so many books on the Nazis, and yet this story has never been told. How did you learn of Leon Lewis, and how come we haven't heard of him before?
Well, that's two different questions. The first one is, how did I learn of him? I was writing when I was doing Hollywood Left and Right. It's a book about 10 Hollywood figures, 9 actors, and Louis B. Mayer, 5 on the left, 5 on the right. And I was writing about Edward G. Robinson, and I was particularly interested in his involvement with the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League, which was organized in 1936 with the idea of using the celebrity of movie stars to publicize the dangers of Nazism and fascism. And so in order to learn, I wanted to know a little bit more, and I went online and I found this website from Cal State Northridge, from their special collections division in the library, called In Our Own Backyard, Nazis and Fascists in 1930s, 40s in L.A. And I knew nothing about it, so I went out there, thought, well, you know, maybe I'll see something. And there were well over 200 boxes, and it was like just too much material to look into for what would have been maybe a paragraph or two. But I decided I wanted to check it out after I was done with Hollywood Left and Right. And so I did. I went back and realized it took me a while because everything was written on a need-to-know basis. So it was hard to figure out what was going on. But eventually I realized it was a spy ring being run out of L.A. Starting in the summer of 1933 by one man, Leon Lewis, who had been the founding executive secretary of the Anti-Defamation League. And he was so distraught when Nazis held their first open meeting in Los Angeles at the end of July 1933, he thought, you know, Jewish groups are debating what to do, and there's a strategy, but they're so deeply divided that Nazis are organizing and holding open meetings and no one's doing anything. And so he went to the Disabled American Veterans, which he was part of. He recruited 4 of his friends, 4 fellow veterans, and their wives, and asked them all to go undercover and join every Nazi and fascist group in L.A. and to try to rise to leadership positions and to send him daily reports on what they were doing. And from 1933 to 1945, Lewis kept that spy ring going, turning over spies as they would testify and then bringing in new spies, and he kept the city safe for that 12-year period.
And why hadn't we heard of him before?
Well, I think that there is no answer. I can speculate, and I think it's a mea culpa for my generation of historians who looked at the end of World War II, realized that Nazism had failed, Germany collapsed, but the Soviet Union came out very strong. And so historians never really, when they look back, never took the Nazi fascist threat seriously in America. Instead, they looked very deeply at communists and socialists in the 30s and 40s. And they let the history of right-wing activism basically go unwritten. And now it's begun to change. Given the political climate, historians are looking once again to right-wing groups in the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Well, I had always thought that the vehement anti-communism of the 50s was a reaction to having not done anything or done enough to stop Hitler. But in your book, I can see that the House Un-American Activities Committee and the FBI were very concerned about communists well before World War II, and they didn't seem to care about Hitler.
No, well, in large part, I would suggest J. Edgar Hoover was probably an anti-Semite. Let me put it this way. When I asked for the Freedom of Information file on Hermann Schwinn, who was the leader of the Nazis in L.A. from 1933 to Pearl Harbor, and was the number two Nazi in the United States. So we're talking about a major figure. The FBI records that I received back started only after Pearl Harbor, that the information the FBI, the Navy, and the Army intelligence had accumulated on Nazis and fascists in L.A. came almost exclusively from a two-man operation, Leon Lewis and his chief assistant, Joe Roos. They were compiling surveillance material and sending it from 1939 on, sending it every year to the FBI, Army Intelligence, Navy Intelligence, that did nothing. And the FBI in 1940 wrote, the local office wrote J. Edgar Hoover saying, look, we need to put Hermann Schwinn under surveillance. And Hoover wrote back saying, Schwinn has broken no laws, therefore you can't put him under surveillance. Even though he did have the FBI putting movie stars, directors, producers under surveillance, who also broke no laws. And it wasn't until 3 weeks before Pearl Harbor, after a series of sabotage incidents on the East Coast at munitions plants, that Hoover finally agreed that the Los Angeles FBI could put the number two Nazi under surveillance. But first, they said they had to send an agent to Washington to be trained in counterespionage. So right through Pearl Harbor, the FBI did almost nothing in terms of surveillance of Nazis and fascists, but put most of their energy in surveilling communists, alleged communists and leftists.
And that wasn't the only law enforcement agency that, you know, neglected. Do you think there was a lot of anti-Semitism in the government and government agencies?
Well, we know there was in the State Department. Leon Lewis reports that the local FBI had was mixed. There were some sympathetic to the Jews, and there were at least in 1940-41, there were at least five very pro Nazi fascist FBI agents in L.A. And I will tell you, the Sheriff's Department and the Police Department were suffused with pro-Nazis and pro-Silvershirt. People actually joined the Silvershirts, which were the American fascists.
Well, now, of course, you're also a historian of Hollywood and Hollywood history, so what about the production code? How much was there anti-Semitism there? I mean, they seemed to support... They didn't want you to say bad things about Germans in films.
Well, that's less anti-Semitism than what they saw as business trumped everything. And that came in the July 1934, the code under pressure from many religious groups, particularly from very outspoken Catholic groups who thought there was too much sex and violence and crime in the screen. They passed their production code with the do's and don'ts of what producers can do. And one of the sections, I believe it was Article 10, or Section 10, said that any studio that wanted to get a production code seal, and you needed to get that seal of approval to get into a first-run movie theater, and you had to be in a first-run movie theater because that's where studios made 70 to 80% of their profit. So if you wanted to get that seal, you could not make any movie, according to this section, that mocked, derided, attacked, or in any way denigrated a foreign nation or its leader. So that meant studios couldn't make a film about any government or any figure in a kind of mocking way, or they wouldn't get a production seal. And if you didn't get that seal, you could pretty much kiss your job goodbye. And so that would not change until January 1940, and that's when we got a spate of anti-Nazi movies like, you know, The Great Dictator and others. And the first anti-Nazi movie made in America by a studio came in April 1939, And that was called Confessions of a Nazi Spy. And the only reason that passed the production code is it was the true story of a spy ring that was being tried in New York City. And so the code couldn't apply because they weren't denigrating or attacking anyone. They were just reporting on this spy ring that they had, that the FBI had uncovered in New York City.
As a good movie with the previously mentioned Edward G. Robinson.
Yes. I think it's a very interesting movie. I don't think any of your listeners who watch it are going to be on the edge of their seats, but it's a really interesting historical look at this period. And also interesting because it's the first time Hollywood openly dealt with the question of Nazis in America.
What about some of the other films that you mentioned? The Mortal Storm was one.
Those all came out afterwards, and many of them, that would get Hollywood in trouble because by 1941, at that June, Germany attacked Russia. They had had a non-aggression treaty, and the minute they attacked Russia, Russia, you know, declared war against Germany, and they became part of our allied group. And so the studios were urged by the Roosevelt administration to turn out pro-Russian movies, not pro-communist per se, but pro-Russian movies because Russia was now our ally. And whatever disagreements we might have between capitalism and communism, they paled in comparison to the dangers that Nazism and fascism presented to the world. And so again, studios were urged to make those films, and they eventually would discover that no good deed goes unpunished. And after the war, many of those studios and the people who made those films would be called before the House Un-American Activities Committee and accused of either being communists or, in this wonderfully bizarre expression, people who were alert to the dangers of Hitler before U.S. entered the war and who tried to raise an alert for other Americans were labeled by HUAC as premature anti-fascists who had to be either Reds or closely associated with Reds, because only communists would have recognized this.
That's weird.
It's more than weird. It is. It truly is one of the darker moments in American history.
It makes me think of the film Ninotchka. How were they able to get away with Ninotchka? That kind of makes fun of Russia, doesn't it?
Yes, because it's still... you know what? You can make fun of Russia. You're not attacking Russia. It's a comedy. Uh-huh. So, you know, it's a comedy.
Yes. Yeah, kind of.
And even one of the characters in my book, The German Council to Los Angeles, George Gisling, snuck off with his daughter one day. I interviewed her, and she told me. And they went to see Ninotchka, and her father thought it was hilarious. So he was a German with a sense of humor.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Stephen J. Ross. He's the author of Hitler in Los Angeles, How Jews Foiled Nazi Plots Against Hollywood and America. Professor Ross, how did the Third Reich attempt to influence America?
Well, Hitler and Joseph Goebbels, his minister of enlightenment and propaganda, were both major movie fans, and they liked Hitler in particular, liked watching a movie every night before he went to bed. And they both believed that one of the reasons Germany lost World War I was because of the effective propaganda put out by the American and British movie industries. And they were determined that this would not happen again. And they knew that if Hollywood really focused on making anti-Nazi films, that it could cause trouble for Germany, because they wanted to keep certainly the United States and many parts of the world neutral as long as possible, which really meant until Hitler could put together an effective army. And so in May 1933, they sent over George Gisling, who had been a vice consul in New York, and they made him the consul in Los Angeles. And he was sent with one mission only, which was to prevent Hollywood from making any anti-Nazi film. Once the code was passed, a year after he started, his job was made much simpler. But even before the code, he came armed with Section 15 from the German import law of 1931, which said any nation that makes or any studio that makes a film that denigrates or attacks Germany or German leaders will have all its films banned in Germany. And if enough films, anti-Nazi films, come out of any one country, the entire nation's product will be banned in Germany. And Hollywood studio heads took that seriously because Germany was the number two foreign market in 1933, number two to Great Britain. And so Gisling asked to see movies before they were released, any movies dealing with Germany or German figures. He would watch them, he would screen them, and then he would give the studio notes of how to change them, all very politely written. The only studio that early on said to him, basically, go screw yourself, was Warner Brothers. And the German government, in turn, banned its films in Germany until the Warners kind of backed off a little bit and changed things. So his task was made much easier after the code, but even then there were certain actors and studios that thought, well, maybe we could press things, and they would make some of Eric Remarque's movies, novels into films, you know, All Quiet on the Western Front and other films like this. And even then, when it wasn't necessarily anti-Nazi, but critical of the German government in World War One, Gisling would, in some instances, call in the movie stars, the German and Austrian movie stars who were in those productions, and very gently say, you know, you can do whatever you want, but we would appreciate it if you would not participate in this movie, and we just want to remind you, we know where all your relatives live in Germany and Austria, and it would be a shame if anything happened to them. And many of them dropped out of the films because they were afraid for their families living abroad.
How much of the moguls who ran the studios, who were mostly Jews, were they afraid of being labeled Jew? Did that play a role in the lack of critical films about Germany?
Well, you have to understand, let's take a step back. First of all, Hollywood is in the money-making business, not the consciousness-raising business. The first obligation of every one of the studio heads that by the 30s are basically corporations, they have an obligation to their stockholders. And their stockholders are not going to be happy if they put their religious needs ahead of the studio needs. And so studio heads basically backed off. They weren't going to make anti-Nazi movies that couldn't get shown in first-run theaters, which would have meant they would have lost a lot of money. And if you lose money, you're going to eventually lose your job. So we've had a number of books written about them, and most recently in 2013, a book called The Collaboration, Hollywood's Pact with Hitler, that argued, we know that, by Ben Irwin, we know that Hollywood had always cooperated with Germany, but it was more than just cooperation. He argued that it was collaboration. Well, one of the things he never noted was that while the Hollywood producers kind of held their nose and continued doing business with Germany, they were also the ones who had a secret meeting at the Hillcrest Country Club here, which was the country club opened by wealthy Jewish businessmen, studio heads, in 1920, after they were systematically excluded from every other country club in the city that basically banned Jews. They had a secret meeting there in 1934 in March, where the 40 of the major studio heads and producers came because Leon Lewis had been running Aspiring and was just about out of money. And Lewis told them at that meeting what was going on. He told them about Nazi activity in the city. He told them about Nazi plots to seize armories in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and San Diego on the same day, with the idea of starting a revolution in America, a plot that his spies had foiled. And he also told them that Silver Shirts, who were, again, as I said, the American equivalent of the Nazis, had penetrated their studios and were systematically firing every Jew in what we call below-the-line Hollywood, that is, your blue-collar Hollywood, your carpenters, your electricians. And he finally told them that Nazis, a number of Nazi groups, were planning assassinations, and their names were on those hit lists. And that evening, at the end of the evening, those moguls who didn't want to, you know, jeopardize their business with Germany, nevertheless, gave him, in the equivalent of 2018 dollars, $424,000 a year to fund his spy operation. So again, there are two sides to the story. While publicly, the moguls continued to do business with Germany, privately, they were funding this spy ring that effectively protected both Los Angeles and the West Coast from murder, espionage, and sabotage.
Stephen Ross, I was also struck in your book by, and I can't remember the percentages that you named, but that a large percent of Americans in the 1930s believed that the Jews had somehow brought it upon themselves, the oppression of the Nazis, and that a majority of Americans, or a large percentage of Americans, were largely indifferent to the plight of Jews and thought that Jews should be sanctioned in some way.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't say Jews should be sanctioned. Let's talk about the two statistics by the Gallup poll. One in November 1936, which is still early, but the United States was very isolationist then. They wanted nothing to do with Europe, and Gallup took a poll where 95% of Americans said they did not want to get involved with anything going on in Europe. And more striking is, as late as July 1941, and now we're talking virtually 2 years after the war and just a few months before Pearl Harbor, even then, as late as July 41, 79% of Americans wanted nothing to do with the war in Europe. And a number of the polls that were taken showed either a majority or close to majority felt that Jews were somehow responsible for what was happening to them in Germany, that they bore some responsibility. I mean, it was vaguely worded, but it was still blame the victims for being the victims.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're getting back to our conversation with Stephen J. Ross. He's the author of Hitler in Los Angeles, How Jews Foiled Nazi Plots Against Hollywood and America. And what about President Roosevelt? This is kind of the outside the scope of your book, but when did he become aware of the Holocaust, or did his advisors tell him that the treatment of Jews in Europe was exaggerated because they believed it, or they were anti-Semitic, or what?
No, I think Roosevelt knew very early on. He had Rabbi Stephen Wise, one of the most, probably the most outspoken Jewish leader in the country, who had his ear. He also had Felix Frankfurter. He had Bernard Baruch. He had New York Times. There were articles about Dachau, opening Dachau as a political prisoner camp, and then later on also bringing Jews. There were the newspapers were filled with stories about the concentration camps. Roosevelt and Roosevelt's own people in Europe told him. He knew this, but what many Americans today don't realize is our country, what is happening now is not new. It's just a resurfacing of the old. The United States was very anti-Semitic in the 30s and 40s. You would have Congress people on the floor of the House reading anti-Semitic diatribes into the congressional record, talking about the Jew deal, talking about President Rosenfeld, talking about how Roosevelt was being secretly run by the Jews. You know, the Roosevelt story is a very complicated one, and you'll have Jews to this day who both love him and who hate him. I think he was caught in a political conundrum where you have limited support for America going into war, and Roosevelt is throughout the 30s trying to move the country towards the idea that one day we will get into this war. And in the meantime, if the country sees this as moving towards supporting Jews, it will all evaporate. And so he had to walk this very tightrope between trying to help move us towards involvement against Germany, Italy, and Japan, while at the same time not appearing to be, you know, doing this because of his, quote, love for the Jews. So he was in a tough position.
The book is called Hitler in Los Angeles. And on the when I tell people, they say, what are you reading? I said, Hitler in Los Angeles. They kind of giggle like they don't have any idea that there was a Nazi presence in Los Angeles. But you present quite a bit of it. And on the cover of the book, it says Los Angeles, and then there's a big swastika flying. So what was their presence, and when did their presence emerge?
Well, their presence back in March 1933, Adolf Hitler sent out Captain Robert Pape, who had been a World War I veteran, to Los Angeles to start organizing pro-Nazi groups all along the Pacific coast. And he organized what was then known as the Friends of New Germany, which, to sound more American, in 1936 changed their name to the German-American Bund. And the idea there was to present a very friendly public face of Germany to the American people, that Germany was, you know, loved America, blah, 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 and that they were friends, and that, you know, they were trying to do what Americans probably wanted to do, which is get rid of the German menace. But there were two things they were doing. One was, you know, organizing these open groups, and the first open meeting in L.A. was held July 26, 1933. But behind closed doors, they were working with the Silver Shirts, with a wide variety. There were easily several dozen fascist groups in L.A. It wasn't just one or two. And my book has a map of Nazi and fascist L.A., and you just see the downtown is inundated by all these fascist groups. And they were, many of them, were secretly, including the Ku Klux Klan, the American Nationalist Party, the Silver Shirts, the White Russians, were all working with the Nazis, with the Bund, on a series of plots that I document from 1933 until Pearl Harbor to murder Jews, to blow up defense installations, and to sabotage aircraft factories, all of which was stopped by Leon Lewis and his spies.
Did they succeed in doing anything?
The Nazis?
Yeah.
No. No, unlike the East Coast, where there were a number of explosions and clear sabotage of, again, munitions plants, there were no major events in L.A. or Southern California. And again, in large part because of Leon Lewis and the network of spies he had, and informants. He had a number of people working for him full-time, but he also had informants, particularly in the aircraft factories, and L.A. was the largest aircraft manufacturer in the country then, who would tell him of overhearing conversations of Germans talking about or German Americans, that if the United States went to war against Germany, they would be sabotaging the planes. They would be unscrewing screws, the bolts would be loosened, and that planes would not fly, or if they flew, they would crash. And he was getting all kinds of word about this. As soon as Lewis heard, he would then contact both the head of security at the aircraft factory and the FBI, and a number of arrests were made along the years.
What about the Los Angeles Police Department?
Well, let's put it this way. They were involved with, a number of police were involved with one of the, I think the one of the worst plots, which was to blow up the homes of 24 Hollywood figures, 22 Jewish leaders and two movie stars known to be too close to the Jews, Charlie Chaplin and James Cagney. And part of the people working on this were in the police department and the sheriff's office. And I found they were involved, again, not a lot, but a number of them were involved with plots, but many more were very sympathetic to the Silver Shorts. And I know this because I have the Silver Short records, and they talk about how the, you know, the police, there are police and sheriff's people inside active members.
Leon Lewis, the hero of your book, said that only in a unified America could the nation and its citizens achieve the true realization of the American democratic ideal. Regardless of one's political affiliation today, everyone can agree that we're not unified in the United States, and the idea of union in Europe is under siege. So, Stephen Ross, do you believe a totalitarian government is coming back?
Well, I don't know if totalitarian government is going back, but we have a president that I would argue poses a greater danger to democracy than anyone we've probably ever seen in office. And the interesting thing to know about Leon Lewis is that during the course of his spy operation, 12 years, he had only one Jewish spy. Everyone else was a Christian. And they all knew, that Leon Lewis was a Jew and that they were working for Leon Lewis as their spy master. But they never conceived in their mind that they were working for the Jews, per se, or they never saw Leon Lewis primarily as a Jew. He was a retired officer in the military, and as far as they were concerned, they were fighting an American battle, that when a foreign group comes into our country and tries to turn American against American, it is up to every single man and woman in this country to protect every other American, no matter their race, their religion, or their ethnicity. And they felt this is what it meant to be an American. You may not like Jews or Catholics or Protestants or blacks or Native Americans, whatever. That's up to you. But as an American, you don't allow somebody else to come into our country and start preaching hate, and worse yet, trying to kill them. And that's where they drew the line. They said, no, we are not going to allow this to happen in our country. And I could tell you this, there is not a single one of these Christian spies who would have ever looked at the Ku Klux Klan or any of the white supremacist groups and then looked at their opponents and said there are good people on both sides. They would have said every single Nazi, every fascist, every Klan member is a bad person and a bad American, period. And I think where we are now is people are being swayed by a demagogue who is preaching, who is turning American against American. And that, to me, is not a Democratic or Republican issue. That's an American issue. And it is simply wrong. It is simply wrong.
Well, this is a story, it's a spy story, although there are no martinis, not shaken or stirred or any martinis at all that I can find. But
no.
yet, it's still, there's going to be a movie of Hitler in Los Angeles, is that right?
Well, I hope so. The book has been optioned, and right now the two producers are pitching it and are getting positive responses, but... As Pauline Kael once said, Hollywood is the only place you can die of encouragement. So I've got a day job at USC, and I hope for the best.
My guest is Stephen J. Ross, and the book is called Hitler in Los Angeles, How Jews Foiled Nazi Plots Against Hollywood and America. Professor Ross, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Recently, I dropped by Good Morning Monterey Bay, our morning program with Rosemary Charmers, to talk about books.
I'm in the studio with me, as he is every other week, Gary Shapiro, host of From the Bookshelf. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. It's a pleasure. You've got a big stack of books this
morning.
Big books.
They're big. This is the works, the complete works, I would say, of Robert Caro. Are you familiar with Robert
Caro? The name is familiar, yes.
He's just published a new book, and it's a fabulous, and it's just a little tiny book.
These are huge.
Yeah, all of his books are gigantic, except his new one, which is called Working, Researching, Interviewing, Writing. It's only about 200 pages, but here it is. And he's 83 years old. He's a fabulous writer. This is in the years he's been writing, and this was first book was published in 1973. This is his total output.
That's a huge amount of books. I mean, you're only it's only five books, five but they're books. Massive.
Yeah, he's written six books, including this new memoir, and he's working on the fifth volume of a projected three-volume history of President Johnson. His first book, which was published in 1973, is this one. It's called The Power Broker, and it won the Pulitzer Prize. And it's the story of Robert Moses. Robert Moses was a guy who for 50 years, almost 50 years, was the city planner of New York, and he was responsible for building all the roads and Jones Beach and all the things that happened, bridges and everything in New York. He was a very, very powerful guy, never elected to anything, and he held the reins of power through all the governorships, you know, and nobody could stop him, you know, from doing the things he wanted to do. And many of the things he did were great, including, you know, building Jones Beach and so on. But also, many of the things he did were terrible. He destroyed neighborhoods, and he didn't care. And he also catered to the wealthy. So when he built a highway that led out to Jones Beach, you know, it went through the properties of some rich guys. And they said, we don't want it to go through these properties. And so they basically gave money to make sure that it wouldn't go through there. And then it went through some guy's farm, some poor guy who just had a little farm, and it tore his farm in half. And he said to the guys, you know, if you could move it 100 feet this way, you know, then it wouldn't destroy my farm and I could still have a farm. But they wouldn't move it an inch for him, but they moved it 6 miles, you know, to get away from his rich.
From the wealthy, yeah. Yes.
So when Robert Caro, who wrote the book, he had been a Newsday reporter, and he thought that he would write this book, and he got a grant that gave him 12 months to pay his salary and write the book. And he said, oh, this is great. He said to his wife, we'll be able to go to France for our vacation, because it'll only take me 9 months to write the book, and I've got 12 months of salary. Well, of course, he worked on this book for like 6 years before it was over.
And his wife is still pissed off at him.
Oh, well, she was really mad at this next book. So he's not interested in writing biographies. He's interested in writing about how people get power and what they do with power.
Okay.
So after he wrote this book about Robert Moses, he tackled a three-volume biography of Lyndon Johnson, which, as I said, these were eagerly awaiting volume five of this three-volume. And volume five will be the last one, and Caro is 83, so we're waiting on, you know, to see if it'll happen. And I'm sure it will. But this is the first one, The Years of Lyndon Johnson. They're all called The Years of Lyndon Johnson, but this was The Path to Power. And it's about the young Lyndon Johnson and how Johnson became first a congressman, then a senator from Texas. And Caro felt that he couldn't really get the feeling of Johnson's young life in the hill country of Texas unless he actually went to the hill country of Texas and moved there. Because as he went there to interview people, they just thought, well, he's a reporter. He's going to leave the next day. But when he actually moved there and lived there, he was able to really get the story. And the kind of dedicated writer he is. And when he told his wife, you know, we're going to move to the Texas hill country, they're New Yorkers, you know. And she said, couldn't you write a book about Napoleon? So, and that's a great book. And then the second one in the series, The Means of Ascent, Lyndon Johnson, The Means of Ascent, it tells the story of how Johnson stole an election in 1948. And it was always iffy, you know, he might have stolen it. In fact, he had a derogatory nickname in the Senate, which was Landslide Lyndon, because he had won by a very narrow margin. But in fact, he had stolen the election, and Caro proved it, that he had stolen it.
I would never have thought that Lyndon Johnson, there was this much information about him.
Well, you have to be a guy like Robert Caro to go and really, really, really look for it.
Well,
and
just
continuously talk to people and interview them again and again and again, the same people over and over again, and asking them the same questions. What did you see? What did it look like? What did you see? You know, and it's amazing. And then in this next volume, The Years
of Lyndon Johnson, even bigger than the others.
Yeah, The Master of the Senate, it tells the story of how Johnson got to the United States Senate and how he really made the Senate work. It had never worked before, and it hasn't worked since. And he made it work in an incredible way and was able to do things in the Senate that had never been done before. And, you know, throughout Johnson's life, Caro points out, there are great things and terrible things side by side.
Yeah.
You know, he's not telling you, he doesn't have an agenda, Robert Caro, well, really, other than to talk about power, how it's used, and how it affects us.
Oh, and those are all necessary things for us to know about.
Yeah, and this book kind of comes to an end when Johnson's Senate career ends, when he becomes the Vice President of the United States, which Johnson considered to be the end of his career, because what do you do when your Vice President is, you know?
Yeah.
And especially since he was older, no, he wasn't old, but he was older, and here was this young president who was probably going to be president for 8 years, but that isn't what happened, as we know. And in the next book, The Passage of Power, in a second, with the crack of a rifle, Lyndon Johnson becomes president of the United States. And that leads, you know, to another amazing period in which he did great things, including the Civil Rights Act. He incorporates We Shall Overcome in his speech, and he makes, you know, Martin Luther King cry when he says it in the Senate. And at the same time, hundreds of thousands of deaths as a result of the war in Vietnam, 68,000 Americans and untold numbers of Vietnamese.
Yes.
So it's, again, side by side. So the work of Robert Caro, it's amazing.
For somebody who might be interested in Lyndon Johnson, can each one stand alone?
Stand alone.
Okay.
They all stand alone. In fact, just the introductions to each one are fascinating. You know, the introductions are the equivalent of a book, you know.
This is a very prolific writer, goodness me.
Well, of course, it takes a long time to write them. He's been writing, you know, this, some historians have written in the period that Caro has written these six books, have written 60 books.
Yeah.
But not to the degree of detail that Robert Caro achieves.
And so what is his new book then?
So it's a memoir, but it's not a memoir of his, it's not an autobiography in any way. It's just a book about how he goes about writing, how he interviews, how, you know, he is absent from all of these books except his new one. That is, the word I never appears in any of these books. But in the new book, he talks about how he became a writer, why he became a writer, what he was out to achieve in each book. And he talks about, you know, incidents when he went to the Hill Country in Texas and he found out, you know, one of the things that Johnson did was he brought electricity to the Hill Country. And what that meant, that the way these the women of the Hill Country all grew old by the time they were 40. They were old and stooped because of carrying water.
Yeah.
You know, and what it meant that he brought this electricity there. And how he went there and really met these people and really told their story. And now they're not alive anymore to tell their story. And their children aren't even alive anymore. So now the grandchildren of these women, they know the story of their people because of the book that Robert Caro wrote.
Huh. That's very interesting. And that he would, I mean, that's what you're calling research to the max.
Really, absolutely.
To make that kind of move.
And, you know, spending time in the library, you know, just looking at every article, every little, he says, turn every page. That's his motto.
I wonder what his wife said once they moved to Texas.
She's been his assistant, working with him closely throughout this whole career. Yeah.
Fantastic. Really amazing. So the author is Robert Caro, C-A-R-O. And across the table from me this morning is Gary Shapiro. His program is From the Bookshelf. It airs at 7 p.m. Monday evenings here on the mighty 1080. So check it out. Who have you got this week?
Olivia Newton-John will be with me on Monday.
Wowza, good job. Nice get.
Yeah, let's get physical.
Well, there we go. We'll see. Lovely. Thanks so much, Gary.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate your time this morning.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.